This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast Podcast. Best bits from the show on Wednesday, June the 26th, where, of course, we talked all things aviation. I mean, give us a day when we don't talk all things aviation. It's one of the industries that dominates here. Why we had that latest story out of Airbus, but also the Skytrax awards or rankings have been released. And it goes without saying that a number of the Middle East and Asian airlines have done very well again in those latest rankings. Plus Saudi Arabia, big talking point for us. Latest prediction suggesting it's set to become the world's largest construction market. That's according to new numbers from Knight Frank. So we've got a bit of reaction to those numbers. Andrew Hammond reacted to those numbers. He is Saudi editor for AGBI, but he was also in studio to talk to us about the recent Hajj pilgrimage, the investment into the Hajj infrastructure, the investment into so-called religious tourism into and out of the country, but also the sad story coming out of Hajj this year that a number of deaths were reported. Wanted to get his thoughts on that and what's been done about it over in the Kingdom of. Espen Mettelum is the head of Energy Transition Intelligence at the World Economic Forum. We had Espen join us to tell us a little bit about the new report by WEF that warns that energy transition is slowing down, with the UAE ranked in 52nd place globally. Got a better reading on that. And we also got Mustafa Hussainin. Mustafa is a director for HKA. They're a consultancy that work with a number of major organisations, especially to deal with disputes and disruptions in the construction field and others as well. The reason we got Mustafa in was to talk about the new rainwater drainage system. Huge investment and announcement earlier on in the week. A 30 billion dirham undertaking by the government here in Dubai. But we wanted to get a little bit of insight into what can be expected, any advice that HKA could proffer to those behind the project moving forward. And is there any other precedent for this in the region? That's all right here on the Bite Size Business Breakfast Podcast.
Let's look at some of our top stories this morning. And that report from Knight Frank, Brandy. Saudi's going to be the biggest construction market in the world. I mean, that seems staggering. It's a country of, what, 30, 40 million people? Tiny by the standards of China, India, the United States, Indonesia, and yet the biggest in the world.
Do you know what it reminded me of?
Tell me.
Do you remember in the early 2000s, the early noughties, I think we call them, when there was that sort of acropophical, word I've only ever seen written down, don't really know how to pronounce, statistic that Dubai was home to about 75% of the world's cranes or something?
Nonsense, but yeah.
Yeah, like who's counting? But apparently, by the way, people do count. There is actually some kind of crane register. The thing that got me about these numbers from Knight Frank, and they are really interesting, is the rate of growth rather than just the sheer number. I mean, the sheer number is big, $180 odd billion, but I don't work in construction. You do sort of think, okay, well, it's a lot, but is it a lot or a lot? What is really interesting is that they want to do that in five, well, they plan to do that in 5 years if you add up all of the projects that are ongoing, which is what Knight Frank has sort of done. That is nearly a third more spend on construction, so arguably projects themselves, than we were at the end of last year.
So it's relatively easy to knock up architects' plans and nice 3D renders of these things, but it's very difficult to actually build the things, isn't it? You were talking to someone in construction quite recently about this.
Yeah, who was looking after a really big residential project and said that they were using up a vast amount, like if everything that they did went to plan, they alone would be sucking up a vast amount of the actual sort of concrete and stuff that was produced in the kingdom. And they said the big thing is materials and making sure that they have enough materials. Now, we know that Saudi Arabia, like the UAE, has a massive industrial strategy, and it wants to be producing an awful lot more things inside the kingdom. We should get, I don't know who the sort of the steel rebar and concrete analyst we need to speak to is. I'm sure there is one. Is it as easy as just knocking up a few more concrete factories? I don't know.
Well, we've been asking that question to Andrew Hammond, who's the Saudi editor of Arabian Gulf Business Insight. Remember, we just heard from him about the tragic situation with Hajj last week. But we also asked him when he was in the studio about this construction story. And the question is, where will Saudi get the money, the materials and the manpower to make this $180 billion construction boom reality?
The money, the materials and the manpower for Saudi Arabia's massive economic transformation, it's become problematic. It's fundamentally relying upon the government's revenues, ironically from oil and gas, given that the plan is to move away the economy from that resource base. At the same time, the government is relying upon, and its institutions which are leading the economic transformation, are relying upon the international debt markets as well, and also investment, foreign direct investment, which is being a problematic issue right now because the figures are not where the government hoped they would be. At the same time, materials and manpower, these are subject to the international market. The demand for concrete in Saudi Arabia has become absolutely huge. So they are managing to do this, and the manpower as well. They're bringing the manpower in from outside the country. Those issues are okay. The problem they have is with the money to a certain point. There are delays in the projects right now, but everything generally is still moving forward.
Andrew Hammond of AGBI. Other stories we're looking at today, a couple of aviation ones. We've got the Skytrax Awards out, and there are many aviation awards, but the first among equals is probably Skytrax. Maybe I'm doing a disservice to others, but it's certainly very closely watched, isn't it? And it's out.
Yeah, it is indeed. So, well, I would say the top two players are not the most interesting thing about this. There is a little tussle every year that goes on between Qatar Airways and Singapore Airlines to see who is going to get the top spot. This year it is Qatar, with a comment from a brand new CEO, for it is no longer Mr. Al-Bakr who's commenting on these things, but engineer Badr Mohammed Al-Mir, who is now the boss of Qatar Airways. Very proud, etc., etc. Singapore taking number two, but the two of them tend to cross over quite a lot. Emirates coming in at number three, and it's very much an Asian lineup. We've got Japan, we've got Cathay Pacific. Some of the big upsets, Qatar Airways, Qantas, the other Q, has seen one of the biggest drops out of the top 20. And the bit that I find really interesting, given that they are about to get some home competition in the form of Riyadh Air, Saudi Arabian Airlines, getting the award this year for world's most improved airline.
Which is an interesting thing. I'm looking at the methodology for the Skytrax World Airline Awards, and this is what they say. It is the world's largest annual airline passenger satisfaction survey. The focus of the survey is for customers to make their own personal choices as to which airline they consider to be the best. And so, yeah, they have over 100 customer nationalities participated in the survey. I don't have the absolute number for how many people.
No, they don't say, but it is, I mean, it is huge to the point that they check IP addresses and everything to make sure that people don't vote more than once.
It is rigorous. It absolutely is rigorous. But it is a customer survey, and they do. It's a scale of satisfaction 1 to 5. And I'm looking at the breakdown on their website. For cabin service, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. There are 13 subcategories in cabin service. One of them is staff grooming. One of them is cockpit PA information, as opposed to cabin PA announcements.
But hang on, does that mean the captain's welcome is ranked?
It is indeed.
Wow.
Yeah. Cockpit's got talent.
But that's can't fly a plane, but your voice is great.
Indeed. It would be an easier transition from A380 captain to radio presenter than it would the other way around.
Yeah, you could argue thus. I always like to look and see which airlines I have never heard of before. Coming in at number 57, Porter Airlines, anybody?
Mm-mm.
No, me neither. There was Breeze Airways in at 91.
That sounds like something from the trolley rather than the airline itself.
Yeah, Fly Aeristan. I wasn't even sure that Aeristan was a country. Air Domiti. Sounds like a very tasty Greek appetizer. Not sure.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We team up with the team from AGBI. If you want to like to get all the latest from them, get yourself onto their website and, of course, their socials. As we take a look at some of the big stories that are developing across the region, none more so than the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. That's why AGBI have a dedicated Saudi editor. Andrew Hammond is joining us live here in studio. Andrew, really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us. Obviously, we have seen a very significant time, not just for Saudi Arabia, but for the Arab and Muslim world, the world over, the Hajj pilgrimage taking place recently. In fact, concluded, also coinciding with the Eid break and an early summer getaway for many as well. The Hajj pilgrimage, a time of celebration, but also comes with its logistical challenges, none more so than in a year of very high heats as well, and unfortunately, a very high number of deaths during this year's Hajj pilgrimage. Over 1,300 people recorded, according to the Saudi Arabian Health Ministry. What's been the reaction from Saudi Arabia?
Unfortunately, it's quite common that there are a lot of deaths, usually a couple of hundred sometimes, not by disasters, you know, which have happened in the past, like stampedes or, you know, some occasions a long time ago there were fires. You know, these things have happened before, but normally because it is quite a grueling and stressful process. I mean, you're walking around, or as it was before, now there's much more transport, but moving around a large area over a couple of days. So, you know, a lot of people who are a bit infirm, who have illnesses, will succumb under the stress of it. So quite often there are people that die there. The thing that's been surprising or shocking this year is that the number of people is much higher than one would expect, much higher than normal. And it seems to be connected to, well, two things really. One, the extreme heat. Mm. It is being described as higher than normal. I'm not sure if that's true. It was, you know, getting up towards 50 degrees Celsius. That's being said as unusual for this time of year. It may well be. But the other thing is that you have this issue of unlicensed pilgrims, and the Saudi authorities are really trying to be much more organized than they ever have been before, and they're trying to prevent unlicensed pilgrims being there at all. And the issue here is that if you were part of if you were licensed, you had the Hajj visa, you were in a group, that means you have access to all the facilities. Now, because it's become more organized, if you don't have that kind of access, you're kind of left having to wander around. You might not have access to these tented areas, so you're exposed to the heat. And this is being put forward as the problem in this case, that the unlicensed people suffered for the higher organization. They were cut out of these systems, as it were. And so therefore, they were more exposed to the stress of being in that kind of heat, walking around. We don't know exactly what was going on in terms of what their health conditions were. You know, obviously, there's still remnants of respiratory issues going around. Saudi Arabia had warned earlier this year about to wear masks and to be careful in crowds if you were in a situation where that could be an issue for you. But still, it is a lot of people.
The sheer weight of people, as you mentioned there, given the investment into infrastructure in recent years by the kingdom and the authorities there. And I mean, from your perspective, a man who's been on the pilgrimage a couple of times before as well, is there always, just given that sheer weight of people in one place at one time, is there always the potential for this kind of disaster?
There absolutely is. The infrastructure changes, as you say, that they've done are really huge. Mm. They've really expanded the area around. There's an area called the Jamarat where people do this stone throwing ritual towards the end of the few days of the Hajj process, and that's where a lot of the stampedes have happened in the past. Mm. They really expanded that. They turned these columns where stones are thrown were turned into walls to make it easier for everyone who's crowding around those areas. They've even put hotels in some of those areas as well. They've added a metro system that works specifically from right inside Mecca. It goes to the various points because it's kind of a complicated circuit, as it were, that you go around inside Mecca, then outside Mecca, up to this plain outside Mecca. It's about 15 kilometers away. So there's a train that's helping people to move around, as well as all the taxis and everything. So it's become a lot better in terms of the infrastructure. At the same time, the center of the city has been expanded in terms of hotels as well. So the number of people that the city can absorb is a lot more than before, which means that it becomes a lot more of a sensitive issue, actually, that the organization is better as well. Otherwise, you could be accused of having brought even more people into a situation that wasn't 100% safe. But yes, as you say, there's always a certain element of risk. And this one really shows it, because this was a case of being exposed to the heat. I'm sure they had access to water as well. But one thing in this situation, I think what did draw a lot of attention and shock people a little bit was that on social media there were images going around of people lying on the ground, and you didn't know whether they were just they'd passed out or they could even have been dead. So that's what really got people talking about it and talking about it in terms of something that was kind of scandalous or so.
Last 30 seconds with you, Andrew, just in terms of your understanding of the Saudi Arabian vision at the moment, how important is religious tourism for them moving forward?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because with all the expansion that's going on, which is huge, the airports, the local airports, the new airlines, and the effort to bring tourists from around the world to these new sites, and a lot of it's affluent tourism, the fact is that still religious tourism is absolutely central to those plans. Mm. Last year, the number of international visitors were about 27 million. Half of those were religious tourists. So the government knows that religious tourism, if we can call it that, is still incredibly important for their expansion plans. And that's not going to change. Religion is still going to be central to the government's economic plan, fundamentally.
Appreciate your thoughtful reporting on this sensitive subject. The Saudi editor there of AGB. I get all your latest Saudi stories from the team there. Andrew Hammond, thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Big thanks to Andrew for joining us live here on The Business Breakfast.
Catch up on the business headlines with The Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Talking energy now, because a new report by the World Economic Forum warns that energy transition is slowing down. Now, leading countries in the race to go green include Sweden, France, Brazil and China, but many others are lagging behind, including the Middle East, with the UAE down in 52nd place. To find out more, I've been speaking with the author of that report, Espen Mellum, who's head of energy transition intelligence at the World Economic Forum.
In the MENA region, we have Qatar ranking 50th, UAE 52nd and Saudi Arabia 58th. And we have seen a positive trend there. Over the last decade, there's a 7% improvement in the overall scores, a 22% improvement in the readiness for transition, showing exactly that the political commitment, the investments going into the energy transition. And countries like the UAE and Saudi and others have indeed been leading now the trend in terms of investing into renewable energy, but also things like blue hydrogen and other sources. More can be done. There's a huge potential in the region to develop more renewable energy, but also, and this is maybe an area for further improvement, is the energy efficiency. So growing the economy with less energy intensity, that's maybe an area that many countries in the Middle East can improve. There are historic reasons for that, where energy has been cheap. It takes it's a journey. It will take time, but the direction is really positive.
So the general premise of your report, or certainly the headline that's been picked up, is that the pace of energy transition is slowing. In simple terms, what are some of the barriers? What are some of the bottlenecks or problems?
I would say we have seen very positive developments over the last decade, but the two last years, this momentum has been slowing down. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is the geopolitical environment and the economic volatility we have seen. We are talking about global energy systems, interconnected energy systems for interconnected supply chains. Inflation has been hitting hard. The cost of capital has been increasing, especially for emerging and developing economies. This makes it more challenging to mobilize all the investments that are needed. And also for people, energy has become, in many countries and many markets, more expensive. So those are some of the reasons for the slowing momentum. And then obviously there are unsolved challenges such as the full access to electricity for everybody, clean cooking. So much more can be done, and we need to move faster.
Let's look at what Sweden and France and maybe Brazil are doing, and we can do the same. What would be some of those things?
Sweden's journey started back in the 70s, a very fossil fuel dependent economy, but then investing over years in things like nuclear, more recently also in renewable energy, and as well as energy efficiency, and policies like the carbon pricing has been true rising in Sweden, but also driven transformation, I think, has had an impact. And then, of course, also the general investment in education and skills that can be applied to the energy sector are important. France, to take another example, has improved this year, notably due to the energy efficiency improvements. Of course, a lot on the back of the big energy crisis we saw 2 years ago, but also very targeted measures towards those parts of the society that needs the most, which helps the equity dimension of things. And then last, Brazil, very big on biofuels, on clean electricity, and been investing in this and being a pioneer in some of the energy policies. And of course, China is a super major when it comes to investments in renewable energy and energy infrastructure.
Let's talk about carrots, let's talk about sticks, and I gave the example of Norway, your home country. Why is pretty much every car an electric car? It's maybe because petrol's the most expensive in the world.
Indeed, it might be one of the factors, but Norway's been investing in this for many years, and now the sales of new cars is over 90% is pure electric, and it really has to be both a carrot and a stick. It has to be the preferred choice by consumers. And why is that? There have been many advantages, such as tax exemptions, as well as being able to drive in the bus lanes, public parking, cheap charging of the cars. And now it's hit a tipping point where it's the preferred choice. But it's not only Norway. We see also the electric mobility revolution coming, China, of course, but also in countries like India and Thailand, where it's also about the two-wheelers and three-wheelers. And with some investments from the industry, some smart incentives from the governments, one can hit the tipping point where consumers really start using these new solutions.
Some people are questioning the pace of energy transition or the realistic ambitions of energy transition. For example, Amin Nasser, the boss of Saudi Aramco, stood up at a conference in America recently and used the word fantasy. That was his word. It's a fantasy to think that we can move quickly away from hydrocarbons and onto renewables, because 2 billion people experience energy poverty. And you mentioned cooking and heating and cooling, basic needs. What do you make of that idea?
So the world will need energy, need more energy. That's a fact. And energy is a good thing. It drives growth, it drives development. The problem is the emissions. And that's where we have to turn around and find cleaner solution, more efficient solution. Part of that is obviously over time to transition away from fossil fuels in a just and equitable manner, as was the outcome from COP. This is not an easy feat, obviously. The world is based today on 80% on fossil fuels, so we've been pretty stable. So with the growing energy consumption worldwide and this percentage staying fairly flat, the emissions are rising. What needs to happen, though, is to find ways to decarbonize the fossil fuels through CCUS, reduce the emission intensity of fossil fuels, and at the same time, really also boost renewables and boost energy efficiency. It's not like one solution is going to solve it all. We need a transition. Many means are needed.
The thoughts of Espen Mellum, head of Energy Transition Intelligence at the World Economic Forum.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Big news then coming through earlier on this week. Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid, the Vice President Ruler of Dubai, approving an initiative to improve water drainage in the Emirate. The Tasreef project is going to cost around, well, just over $8 billion, 30 billion dirhams, according to the Dubai Government Media Office. They released the news on their X account. Scheme is going to be introduced immediately. It's scheduled to be completed by 2033. As you can imagine, it is a significant investment and therefore a significant project. So, let's get some consultancy on this one, some of the challenges that the project might come into. Let's turn to HKA. HKA is a leading global consultancy in risk mitigation, dispute resolution, expert witness and litigation support. They anticipate, they investigate and they resolve complex challenges. I think it's fair to say that this may well be one. Director of HKA is Mustafa Hussain, who's been kind enough to join us live in studio this morning. Mustafa, good morning to you.
Good morning, Tom.
Great to have you here with us. To get a bit of expertise, your expertise, on all things project management. You're not here to give technical solutions. We'll leave that to the engineers. We'll leave that to the H2O experts out there as well. But let's get look at the project itself. As I said, a significant 700% increase in capacity to the existing infrastructure we have at the moment. Your reaction first and foremost to the announcement we got earlier on this week?
I think it's one of those things which Dubai is known for, is diligence and coming to support its citizens when the need comes. It is an initiative which will take it towards the 100 years, and the infrastructure is for the city and the development of the city, and it's fantastic. And only Dubai can do such things, and to the scale that we are looking at, it's a massive project. Although I would say it is not the only one in the region, and not for the same reasons. A couple of years back, if you say around 10 years back, the situation was same in Jeddah. There were rains, floods, similar projects came on board, and there was massive work. So there is a precedent in the region where things have been done before.
Can we draw precedents from that as well? Are they similar challenges being faced?
Yes. The precedent is quite clear. Although Jeddah, the topography is quite different, because Jeddah, when they investigated early on, is a riverbed, right? So millions of years ago, Jeddah, there was a river which was going. So when the waters came back, it went back. The river flew again and wanted to go to the sea. But there's a city now, right? So the water could not go. Here the situation is slightly different. Here the city is being built, where there was a expanse of desert. So the topographies are quite different, and Jeddah is a very old city. So challenges are different, but the issues remain the same. The main things are, in this region, I've been here for 22 years, and some of the issues which we have seen over and over again over the projects is that the projects go into execution way earlier, even before the design is complete. So when that happens, it is, you exactly don't know what you are facing, because the design is not complete. Generally, you would like to go internationally. There are different stages of the design. So you go 30, 60, 90. At 30%, you would start procuring stuff and go into details. And we have seen for major projects in this region, at 30, they already start groundbreaking. Which is quite a precedent, but it brings different challenges. It's very difficult to predict what design problems will happen. The biggest problem with this project is how you would predict where the water will flow.
Right.
And that is what has happened with Jeddah. Mm. The project was successful. Everything was successful. It was done well. But then when the rains came back, the water took a different route. So that is the most difficult challenge for the designers, and that's up to the designers.
You mentioned that the construction work, and a lot of people moving around the city will have noticed some significant construction infrastructure being put in place. I'm talking about up in the Alawir areas, up in the Al-Wasan areas, in and around Dubai Design District. You'll see some bases where a lot of infrastructure has gone in as well. There's a lot of other construction work going on at the same time. Are they going to be able to deliver this project in line with other construction taking place?
See, I think the beauty of Dubai is that they have recently built the metro stations, right? The metro infrastructure is there, which part of it has gone underground. So they have a blueprint of what is there under the ground. But, you know, we generally call it the brownfield environment. This is more of a brownfield situation where everything is built. So as long as things are new, they have a blueprint of what has been built, they can visualize what and how they are going to proceed. But there might be infrastructure, there might be items under the ground or above the ground which have not been taken into consideration. And that will be a challenge. The metro itself will be a challenge. Because they'll have to bypass it now. They're talking about the tunnel boring machines and stuff. So it depends how deep they have to go in those areas.
And your understanding is the whole project will be subterranean, yeah?
That's the early estimate. But in certain areas where there is built area, there will be subterranean. But in the outskirts, I think it will be on the open. Mm. So it depends. Like in Jeddah, what happened was they had to build catchment areas. Mm-hmm. As I said, it was river coming, right? Here, what they are doing is they are taking that water and they are building a reservoir where they can use the water for future.
Yeah.
Right? So it is a great initiative and it's a great thought. The other thing they are doing is they have taken a plan of 10 years, right? 9 or 10 years, which is a right estimate of time. So plan and manage is one of the key factors of project management. So as long as they can plan it properly in phases, they are saying, it should be okay.
30 seconds left with you, Mustafa, on this one. You mentioned there the plan, manage and monitor being one of your first pieces of advice. Any other advice you could give?
We are dispute resolution firms, and we are very focused on dispute as HKA. Contemporaneous is the word we use to resolve the disputes at the time when the events happen, when the issues happen. That is the time you go and resolve it. Mm. And that saves you time, money, and speed of the project at the time.
Mustafa, you have just proffered some HKA advice for free there to the project organisers here of this significant project. We can't thank you enough for coming in. A big thank you to you. All the best with the works here in the UAE and, of course, over in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Mustafa Hussain, who is the director of HKA, joining us live in studio.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.